Thank you, everyone, and welcome and to this week's episode of Home Centered Sunstone. My name is Josh Allred, and tonight I have the tremendous honor of hosting three of my favorite Mormon historians. Lucky me. We're going to get right to it. We're going to dive right in and do an exclusive preview of Joe Geisner's book that's releasing this week. Is that right, Joe?
It was actually released last week. On Kindle. It was first Kindle because of COVID-19. The Chicago distribution was closed, and so it had actually been sitting in a warehouse for at least weeks.
Well, we're glad that it finally made it to the shelves, and we're glad that people got a chance to get it on Kindle. Lindsay's got her copy. I'm gonna, rep mine right here as well. Had a hard time putting it down this week. So Writing Mormon History, Historians and Their Books. So this historic work is going to offer us a historian's history of historians writing history. So anybody that can say that five times fast can have a signed copy of this Zoom call, signed by me. So nobody important. Also, who better to discuss Joe Geisner's book than our very special guest, Daniel Stone. Daniel, say hello.
Hello, everyone.
And I guess also, who better to discuss the book than the author himself? So, Joe, why don't you say hello so Zoom can see you?
Yeah. Welcome to this live feed event. And I'm not the author. I wish I was good enough to be the author. I'm the editor. Daniel is an author.
That is a very, very good distinction. I appreciate because you're right. This is more of an anthology collection of the historians telling the stories themselves, which is actually pretty exciting. But we do appreciate you putting it together and editing it for us, and so that we can enjoy it as well. So also on the call, we have Lindsay Hansen Park. So Lindsay, why don't you go ahead and say hello for us?
Hello again, everybody. It's such a weird way to, I should be more used to using a video because I talk into the microphone all the time, but this makes me nervous for some reason.
Well, it's okay because Zoom can only see you when you're talking. It's like a T-Rex, but with, noises instead of
moving. As long as I don't move. Josh, can I take a minute to make that announcement?
Please do.
So on behalf of Sunstone, we just wanted to make an announcement to everyone listening. Grace is going to be posting a link in the comment section, but what we have is we're helping a fellow Mormon, Moroni Benali, who's part of the Navajo Nation, gather supplies for his community. It's a pretty dire situation. And so we're asking everyone that's listening to help share or donate if you can. Cash donations are great. They're trying to get supplies to the Navajo Nation. So the link will be in the comments here, or you can go to my Facebook page or to Moroni Benali's Facebook page. And please, please donate something to the Navajo Nation, even if it's just sharing the post. We need your help. So thanks for that, Josh.
No, thank you. We appreciate that. And hopefully everybody goes over and gets involved with that quickly. So I was fortunate enough to get a forwarded copy of the book this week, and it was kind of hard to put down. It's really interesting to hear historians telling the story behind the history. So it's been kind of fun to dig into that and hear some of the best minds we have in kind of the Mormon field and Mormon studies. So I've been really looking forward to hearing from everybody on this. We're going to talk about a quick word from our sponsor, which is all of you watching this, because it's your support that makes us possible for us to do events like Home Centered Sunstone and offer firsthand exclusives with, some of the brilliant people like Joe and Daniel and Lindsay here. So if you are enjoying Home Centered Sunstone and our magazine, our events, our amazing podcast family, please, please, please consider donating to Sunstone through Giblify, our website, our sunstonemagazine.com, or right here on this very Facebook page if you'd like as well. Also, in supporting the cause for the Navajo Nation, like Lindsay mentioned as well. You are all welcome to follow along and engage as we have our discussion. So you can follow along in the comments and send us comments, and we'll be reading them throughout, picking a few of them to talk about throughout the interview. So just jump in. You're part of this too. Let's see. So I guess quick kind of look at some current events going on right now. And we're still all quarantined. So that's the current event right now. So we will be, something come through there. So we're all still in quarantine. Appreciate, everybody that's joining us right now. It's, a weird time to be around. So there's a lot of ways you could be spending this time. We appreciate you spending it with us. But on the brighter side, I guess, everybody here interested in Mormon history. One of the best parts about studying Mormon history has been that when quarantine did hit, at least we all knew how to churn our own butter. So that's been kind of nice. Totally kidding about all of this. Why don't we just go ahead and roll right into it? Because I'm sure everybody's getting tired of my voice. So let's go ahead and go around the room, our respective socially distanced rooms, and everybody kind of introduce yourselves and what you're about and what your thoughts are on the book. So let's go ahead and start with Joe.
Thanks, Josh. And don't forget, we also know how to ride a bike to the wheat grinder to spin the stones so we can grind our own wheat to be able to bake our own bread. We learned all that back in mutual and primary, so we can do that as well. I guess it would help for me I don't have the mute on. I thought I had my mute on. I was approached about 3 years ago by Gary Bejera at Signature Books if I would be interested in doing an anthology. And immediately I thought of articles that I had read over the years with Leonard Arrington discussing, and I was actually at that particular Sunstone event when he spoke on the research and the writing of Great Basin Kingdom. And then that then was published, I believe, in Dialogue. The same Carmen Hardy did I don't know if it was a Sunstone, but he at least wrote an article for Dialogue and talked about his doing the research in New Plural Marriage and the coming out of Solemn Covenant. So those kinds of things were always in my head. And a good example would be Val Avery. I always thought it would be incredible if we had Val write her experience doing both Mormon Enigma and Mission to Madness. That would just be an incredible thing to have. Now, Val did talk, actually Dan Witherspoon and Albert Peck both did Sunstone sessions, and they talked with Val. And those are excellent. Those are great sessions. It just would have been so nice to have had that. So that's what I did, is I just realized I needed to do that. So I approached Gary about that. And Gary said that if I could get people together to do it, that that would be okay. Stepping back, because you would like me to talk a little bit about my background in this, right? Is that something you'd like me to do, Josh?
Yeah, that would be great to, get where you got pulled into the project, where you were, got the opportunity to do the project would be great, and kind of what your background was in compiling these stories together. So,
sure. Thanks, Josh. So, when I, and this is in the introduction, but when I was 16, I think it was the summer, I may have been 17, but it was the summer before my senior year of high school. Yeah, I was 17. And we had gone on a family trip to Minnesota and Wisconsin, came back, and we broke down just outside of Salt Lake, made it into Salt Lake. We were able to stay a few days to get the car repaired. And one day I happened to be in the church office building, and I was looking at the listing of the church historian's office. I think it was called Church Archives back then. And so I'm standing there, and Ron Walker, who obviously I had no idea who Ron Walker was at the time, but Ron Walker walks up to me, and Ron was the true historian nerd. He had glasses that were big, thick things, and it was just great. He was fantastic. And so he said, "Can I help you, young man?" Now, I had a full beard, and I had way longer hair than I even have right now. With COVID-19, we don't get to go have a haircut. But anyway, I had really long hair and full beard, 17 years old. And so I arrogantly said, "Yes, I would like to meet the church historian." And Ron says, "Well, maybe we can make that happen. Let's go upstairs and see if Brother Arrington's available." Took me upstairs. Leonard's secretary was at her desk, and Ron said to her, "This young man would like to talk with Brother Arrington." So she got on her phone and asked Leonard if that was okay. He said yes, had me come in, and we talked, I'm sure, just a few minutes. It felt like an hour, but I'm sure it was not very long. I had read some things while on that trip east, and they weren't what now I wouldn't call them anti-Mormon. I'm guessing at the time they could have been thought of as anti-Mormon. But I read them, and it talked about like the Curtin Bank failure and Parley Pratt denouncing Joseph Smith and those kinds of things, which were shocking to me. So Leonard told me about Story of the Latter-day Saints, recommended that by Jim Allen and Glenn Leonard. Bought that, or that was my Christmas present, along with a couple of other books. I think my mom also got me Lucy Mack Smith's history that Preston Nibley edited. So anyway, so that was what started me on this path. I went to BYU Mission, back to BYU, get married, do all those things, start a family. And my Sunday school teacher, when I was 16, was Lynn Knievel Whitesides, who also at the time was the Lindsay Hansen Park of that day of Sunstone conferences, symposia. And so because of that connection, I was getting fed different articles, different news releases, things like that, along with taking an interest in Sunstone. And when I was at BYU, I'd read Sunstone and Dialogue. And so I just became fascinated with that. My first Sunstone was in Concord, here in California. And I remember sitting there, and Levi Peterson. It was Levi Peterson, I think, spoke. No, it wasn't. It was Linda Sillitoe spoke the first night. It was Levi Peterson that spoke the second night. And, you know, I'm sitting there. Now, I had just bought Salamander, and I had devoured it. I don't think I could put it down. I just sat there and read it. And then now I'm, you know, a week or two after I'd read it, I'm now sitting there listening to Linda Sillitoe. Amazingly gracious person, friendly. And that's what happened when I started going to Sunstones. Now, I had known Mike Quinn from BYU and had talked with him. And I always talked his leg off. But now it was, and then Leonard was attending Sunstone, and so I renewed that friendship with Leonard, but all these other people I started meeting, and then Will Bagley came into my life, and that really changed me, because Will was doing history that was putting Mormon history into the bigger picture of American history. And yes, the New Mormon historians had been doing some of that, but Will did it on a different level. He's a revisionist historian. And that took me to places that I had no idea. And so that took me to meet Bill McKinnon. And so the people in this book all come from all of these different things. When the same's true with Lyndon Newell, and Mormon Enigma, another book I could not put down. An extremely gracious person and very kind. So, and that's what all these people in this book, they've all been kind to me. Will Bagley said it's really Joe likes to be friends with everyone, and that's how he did this book. Maybe that's true, but that's what I felt. So
I would much rather listen to your voice than my voice anyway. So thanks, Joe. It sounds like, yeah, I mean, Will was right. You're definitely the guy for it, because I don't know anybody that says a bad word about you. So if there's anybody out there that can go get the stories, I'm sure it was probably Joe Geiser. Great perspective. Anybody that picks up the book, get a really good in-depth intro into all of this, and kind of deeper into what Joe just mentioned in the introduction there. And it's really, really fascinating the way that this all came together. So, and part of Joe's story. So thank you, Joe, for sharing with that. And,
thank you, Josh.
Will always has some interesting perspectives on things too. And, I really enjoyed his chapter in here. We can maybe talk about that if we get time. Also, you did mention the, haircut. I feel you on the haircuts right now, because, COVID, I'm actually trimming my hair with an old pair of pruning shears at this point. So we're all feeling you, bud. We're all there together. So, Daniel, let's go ahead and you actually contributed to this work, and we're glad that you did, because it's great work. Why don't you maybe jump in and tell us a little bit about how Joe approached you about it. Let's see if he's as charismatic as maybe, he's, letting himself on to be. I mean, how did he approach you about doing this, and what got you interested in the project, and just kind of give us a background of, how that all went down.
Sure. Well, I do have to say that Joe Geisner is a very good friend of mine, and I actually have to thank Joe for the whole fact that the William Bickerton biography even got published. So, in 2015, I went to my first Sunstone conference and did a presentation on William Bickerton and tried to contextualize him within the American Civil War. And Joe was in the session, and he came up to me afterwards and asked some great questions. And then he introduced me to John Hatch at Signature Books and basically was like, John, you need to talk to this guy. And I was so thankful he did, because John gave me his card. John was interested in the book, and that really put the fire under my belly to get the book done. So I really thank Joe for that. And we just became friends over the years. And he approached me at a John Whitmer conference. What was it, 2017, Joe? Yeah, in the hallway we were, talking.
I believe so.
Yeah, we were talking in the hallway, and then he just kind of brought up this book. And I said, that sounds awesome. And Joe is definitely the person to do it. If people don't, Joe's humble, but I'll talk him up a little bit. He's an amazing and avid book collector. He has a huge book collection, especially on Mormon studies and Mormon history. I actually don't even know anybody who has more books than him on that subject. So he's the guy to put this book together. So he was telling me about it, and I said, that sounds great. And he asked me if I wanted to be a part of it. And I kind of was a little hesitant, because he's like, oh, I got Mike Quinn and Linda Newell and all these big wigs in Mormon history. And I hear I'm this new kid on the block, but I was really thankful. And I said, sure, I'll be happy to do it. That's how it kind of went from there. So I was really thankful.
One thing, if I could add to Daniel's comment, is Todd Compton commented how important it was to have Daniel's voice in the book, that it was something, you know, Todd said, Daniel wasn't on my radar until I read the book. So this is the kind of thing that makes me happy about the book.
That's great. Any compliment you get from Todd Compton, I think you'll go ahead and take that. Thank you for that, Daniel, too. And I actually caught one of your William Bickerton presentations at Sunstone a couple years back, and it's one of my favorite presentations I've seen. So I'm glad that that book was able to come to fruition. So I guess we can thank Joe, you know, indirectly for kind of helping with that as well. So I think you kind of touched on it a little bit. You know, this book is really interesting because it's got historians that have been doing this for several years, and it's got a lot of some of the new faces in it as well. So it gives a really good perspective of kind of where we've come from and where we're going as well. So I think that's really good to have. I think I agree. Having your voice in this really helps with it. Also, we'll throw in, I wanted you to know that in the comments here, Tom Kimball wanted to make sure that you knew, Daniel, that you are his third favorite Bickertonite. So just wanted to make sure that you knew that. That's pretty good compliment coming from Tom there.
We all know who Tom's favorite is, right? Daniel, you know. Matter of fact, you wanted him to endorse your book.
No, I don't know. Oh, Alice Cooper?
Yes, Alice Cooper. That's Tom's, obviously that's Tom's favorite. Number two, not so sure, but number one, yeah.
He might have just thrown that number in there just to kind of keep you guessing. So you're probably a close second to Alice Cooper, and he just wants to keep you humble.
Thanks. Yeah, so, no, Tom likes to pull my chain all the time, so I appreciate that, Tom. Thanks.
Glad that he was jumped in on the chat here. So we also have with us the star-studded cast. Couldn't be complete without our Sunstone's own Lindsay Hansen Park. So we would love to, you know, bring you into the conversation as well. You have done a lot of work over the last few years, particularly, you know, your Europolygamy podcast and such with several different projects. What kind of perspective do you want to offer about kind of, you know, Joe's work, where historians have come from and where we're kind of going in the future? So.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, we talked about this off air, but I said to Daniel, I was like, so you're a Gentile, right? And he was like, I guess I am, but you're not a Gentile. Bickertonite counts. We count that. Hey. Do we count it? All the Mormons in the room? Yes. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. Welcome to the crazy party. I'm glad that you're part of us. Joe Geisner and I go way back. He has helped me with my podcast for a long time about polygamy, and he pointed me to stories and just examples of polygamy that I wouldn't have found otherwise. And so one of my weird brags about Joe Geisner is you can give him a topic or a paper and he'll get it to you in an email in like 20 minutes. That's your turnaround time is pretty impressive. So I'm really excited that you were writing a book. I called Joe every once in a while. I called Joe up with my harebrained ideas. And one time I was like, hey, Joe, we should write a book about this. We should write about a book about this. So the fact that he's written about the stories behind the Mormon history is really important. Brian Buchanan and I are working on a podcast miniseries about the history of Mormon history. And I think there are wider applications outside of our Mormon community that are really important. But also, it was so lovely. I'm not all the way through it because I just got it a couple, like a week ago. But right out the gate, your first chapter is poly-aired. And one of the things that Joe introduced to me was this book. This is Bagley series. These are the Kingdom of the West series. Expensive books, very expensive. But this has become one of my most favorite series and my favorite book in Mormon history. And it's largely to poly-aired's credit and Bagley, of course. Polly talks about her own Mormon history. She talks about her own family history in it. And it was really great to see how she talked about her family and why she talked about her family and what motivated her to do that in this book. Polly Aird has done so much great work on apostates. And I really appreciate that in Mormon history, because I think that the majority of Mormon history so often focuses on the faithful, faith-promoting, powerful people in Mormonism. So anyone in the Mormon hierarchy, right? Or anyone associated with the Mormon hierarchy. Polly Aird did something different, and I really like that. She's always looking at the people on the fringes of the communities, and her work reflects that. And I think that if you really want to have a better understanding of Mormon history, you don't just learn about the prophet, right? That prophet doesn't really tell the story of lived Mormonism, but Polly Aird's work does. And so just right out the gate, having her in was really incredible. And we can talk about everything I liked about it, because there's so many. But yeah, I just think that anyone that has an interest, or even if you are just getting involved in Mormon history, this is probably the book that you should start with. Because not only, and I think Joe's talking about doing more because there's so many great authors, but this gives you an introduction to some of the biggest, most important histories we have in Mormonism, and sort of foundational texts and what inspired them. And I think that's really cool.
You've had such a productive pandemic. You listen to all the books you've ever meant to. You listen to War and Peace, The Stand, Middlemarch, and even Infinite Jest. Oh, but you couldn't quite get through In Search of Lost Time. Oh, well. And now you're looking for something just as meaty, but maybe a little shorter? Lucky for you, Sunstone has a treasure trove of audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry at patreon.com/sunstone. Head over and listen to a few of our free episodes, and then subscribe and get access to the best of Mormon thought and experience. Every episode is guaranteed to last less than 46.37 hours. That's our promise to you.
Actually, most of my books here, I've got Daniel's book here. I actually went through to see if I had every single book that we have on here, and I'm close. I actually, and I hope he's not mad at me, but I don't have an actual copy of John Turner's book.
Oh, that's the most important book on Brigham Young.
I know, it's so good.
By far.
So good. I can't remember if I've lent it out to someone. So if I've given you the book, give me my book back.
I actually don't have a physical copy of John Turner's book either. I have it on Audible and Kindle. So I think maybe there's a status, you know, to having the physical copy that maybe I need to level up to so that I can get that level. So I definitely sounds like if you do need some books, Lindsay, that Joe's got a decent library there that you can maybe check some out. You know, everything's digital now and there's a barcode. So there's a whole system to checking out Joe's books now that you can do. Thank you. One of the things you kind of mentioned was, you know, right out the gate, yeah, starting with Polly Aird was, you know, fantastic for me as well. Really resonated with me because, you know, my own journey into Mormon history was heavily influenced by, you know, piecing together my family history, very, very similar to how she kind of told her story as well. So that was really great to kind of get her perspective on that, because my mine was very similar too. In fact, I could probably say that I found myself kind of connecting with every historian's story in some way as they were kind of telling how they brought theirs together. So it was really interesting to almost like you know, humanize the brilliant minds behind all this work and get an idea, you know, what went into producing some of these. Like we're representing for John Turner's book right now, you know, and actually getting to hear John Turner discuss how John Turner's book came together is pretty fascinating. So it's really good to hear. And I think it also kind of shows one of the big takeaways, I think, is and maybe Joe or Daniel, you could talk about this too, is I think the more I read, and the more that everybody was telling their stories, you heard how many historians were part of their own stories. And it wasn't just the history itself, but it was also fellow historians. And it kind of showed how inextricably connected everybody kind of is, and how, you know, one individual research is influenced by, you know, several other historians' research and such. And so it's kind of like layered and kind of augmented on top of each other, you know, as we kind of fill in all these great stories from our past and such. So one historian's dead end on their project could be the missing piece in someone else's project, you know? So I think it's really interesting to see, is that you're reading some of these stories in the book about how many historians themselves are influencing the history.
I agree. You've made me think of a whole bunch of things, and my brain is sort of like, okay. So a couple of things. One is with Polly. And it's interesting with both Polly and Susan Staker. These are both divorced women raising little children and stepping into the whole thing of Mormon history and researching. And now Susan also was, I think she worked a little bit for Leonard before the divorce, but still, you know, when she got full into it, working at Sunstone, and that's what's nice too about Susan's story, and that's why I wanted Susan's story in the book, is Susan was one of the first people that saw the Relief Society, the Nauvoo Relief Society minutes, from a scholarly perspective. They had been housed at the Relief Society building, which most of you wouldn't probably even know what that was, because I think it was tore down and replaced. But the Relief Society had their own building off Temple Square that they built, and they had wheat, they had all kinds of things. And so they also had the minutes, the Nauvoo Relief Society minutes. Nobody knew. Nobody had ever paid attention to that. And Susan and I think Linda were the first two to get to look at those. Susan then got to see the primary, the founding of the primary minutes, because she's a co-author to the church publication, Little Saints. So having her was so important for me.
Can I say something about her really?
Absolutely,
quick?
Absolutely.
What I really love, and I love Susan, I love that she has produced Mormon historians in her family. I love everything about her. But one of the things I love, and I was just trying to look for it, doesn't she talk about reading Lady Chatterley's Lover? And she decides she never wants to censor anything she writes or reads again. Am I remembering that right?
I think so. You know, let me do a quick search and I can tell you. But yeah, I believe that's correct. I believe she did not want, she was going to make sure that, I read Lady Chatterley's Lover in the 10th grade. And vowed no one would ever censor what I read. This is one vow I have kept.
So I love that. Susan, that's powerful. That's just incredible. I love it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So then the other thing I was going through my head with as you were talking, Josh, is Mike Quinn. Now, this is Mike's chapter is very different, if you noticed. It's actually, he gave me his journal entries, so they're actually happening in real time. And then after he left BYU, I believe he stopped keeping a journal at that point, and so that's his memoir that he allowed me to have, to then fill in those gaps. And the thing that Levina Fielding Anderson picked up as she was, as she read, and she was great. She wrote every single author and told them, did she write you, Daniel, too? Did she thank you for your chapter? I'll send her an email. No. Yeah. I'll send her an email with your email. She probably doesn't have your email. But yeah, so she sent a thank you to everybody. And on Mike's, it was really interesting because she said to Mike, I'm so glad you did this because it tells people how you saw this as a calling to be a historian. And that's a really, that comes out. Gary and I talked about Mike's chapter and how probably people will be shocked as they read it, because of what, and it's fascinating. You know, Mike was the guy who went to the administration building next door and went down in the basement and discovered that there were still crates that had been, papers had been put in from the move south in 1858. And of the Utah War, and they had been brought up and just stuck down there, and the massive amounts of Brigham Young papers that were down there. Now, other people knew it, and Mike goes into that detail of who those people are. He names names in his diary or his journal and tells you who knew that those papers were there and didn't say anything. And Mike's the one who discovered. Now, Mike pointed out to me, oh, I'm wrong. That's before the move. They had not moved to the church. So that's what it was, that Mike, the church archives was actually in the administration building. So he had gone down the basement in the same building he was in. Then 72, I think, is when the church office building was built. And so they moved. So Mike said, we would have found them. You know, somebody would have found them because somebody would have gone to the basement. But the fact that those papers had been there and nobody had looked at them in over 100 years, nobody had even taken them out of the box over 100 years. So that's all in Mike's. This sort of gets to what Lindsay says about the dedication. Is Todd Compton's is so interesting. You know, he talks about what he went through to do the research for In Sacred Loneliness. First of all, he talks about, and Susan talks about this too, neither one of them would have ever guessed they would be a Mormon historian in their early professional career and their schooling. But Todd talks about sleeping on people's couches and stuff. So there's some great, there's just over and over. Daniel can talk about this, and I think it would be worth him doing, but I'll just sort of give a little introduction of it. Is Daniel saw, speaking of records not being seen, Daniel was also privileged to see records. So you take over, Daniel.
Yeah. What drew me to William Bickerton was I grew up in William Bickerton's church. I grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ, and known as the Bickertonites, and I'm still a member. And I just very similar to, you know, Susan and Todd, I loved American history. I was going to school to become an American historian, but you know, I was just really interested in William Bickerton because the reason I was interested in him was because there was very little written about him. So I'd imagine, you know, we're kind of like another Latter-day Saint group. Imagine being a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and knowing very little about Joseph Smith. I mean, it sounds crazy, but that's kind of how I was in that boat. We're going like, wait a minute, we're kind of called the Bickertonites and I'm reading the church history books. Why is there not more information about him? That's what really piqued my interest. I really had no idea why. I just thought, oh, maybe the church overlooked it. Maybe it's more spiritual. They're trying to focus on the miracles, which is, I think, part of the case. But never in my wildest dreams did I ever think the story that would come out with William Bickerton would come out. And I realized that there was a story behind the story because little did I know, and I talk about it in my chapter, but little did I know there was this other historian, Gary Enns, that did some great research on Bickerton. And I had no idea that there was all this stuff in newspaper articles and things out in Kansas. And he talked with one of the, you know, one of the elders that we had in our church in Kansas, and he had all these documents that Gary Entz was able to get a hold of and write his great research articles on. And basically, I found out that William Bickerton was kind of really chastised, persecuted by his own church and by his own members. And, you know, the story that I was told in reading the church history books was basically that William Bickerton, there was like this hint of maybe he was an adulterer. And it's the first history book definitely said that. And then he got kicked out of the church. But later in his life, he came back and he was restored to full fellowship. That's the story, right? And then the church continued on. But that's not what happens at all. Gary Entz talks about that. The church split in two for literally 22 years. And you had the LDS elders coming in to Kansas to convert all the Bickertonites because there was all this chaos and they were very successful at doing it. It was a really hot, interesting story that was not mentioned in our church literature at all. And that's what really blew me away, was that, holy cow, there's really a story behind this. So basically getting into it, yeah, I had to basically write these letters to my apostle, to the church's apostles, to get access to the archive. And when I got into the archive is very well organized now. It's getting better. But when I went through it, it was like, just, there was stuff everywhere. But I was able to get a lot of great stuff. I was able to get transcriptions of the early minutes, and that's all I thought existed. So this is the interesting thing. I had this transcription that was done by Idris Martin, who is the assistant church historian, and he also collaborated with Bob Watson, who was the general historian, and then this other elder, Mancini. He basically digitized the minutes, and so John Mancini was the one that did that. And long story short, I'm looking at these transcripts. I thought that this all existed with the minutes, and I have newspaper articles, things like that. It wasn't until months later that the general historian later tells me and says, I think it was years later, as I'm working on the book, he tells me, he says, listen, there's this gentleman that's got a lot of the original church record books that we don't have. He has them, and he's in New Mexico. And turns out it was John Mancini, the guy who helped digitize these transcriptions of the minutes that I had that I was using to write the book. And I'm like, wait, he's got the originals. So I called, but he's like, yeah, but John isn't willing to give them to the church. And there's this whole backstory. It's very controversial how he got the minutes. And he's like, no one's been able to get anything from him. So I actually kind of like knew a friend that knew one of his friends. So then I said to her, can you write a letter to his friend to tell him about me? So, because I just didn't want to cold call him, because I figured he'd just, you know, turn me down. So I went that way. And John was very receptive, and he called me, and he basically said, I'll give you whatever you want. And he had like, he has these digital images of all these books. He's got typescripts of the books, which was wonderful, because then you could text search everything. And so I'm kind of blabbering on, so forgive me. But as you can see, it's a journey to get these, just to get the information. So it was really interesting, and it was fun to do. And, you know, of course, when you do that, you step on toes sometimes, and there's controversy behind things. But I just wanted the story. I wanted to know, why was Bickerton not talked about? I mean, the guy asked for the 19th chapter of Job to be read at his funeral. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm not going to be asking Job to be read at my funeral. We all know it's a super sad, you know, story in the Bible. And this whole chapter, I mean, there's that one nice part that a lot of times funerals talk about. It says, I know that my Savior will on the latter days, he'll stand upon the earth. We know that. They talk about that in funerals. But the rest of the chapter is horrible. And he had the whole chapter read at his funeral. It's, my kinsfolk have failed. My familiar friends have forgotten me. Another part says, oh, that my words were now written, that they are printed in a book, that they are graven with an iron pen and let in the rock forever. And that's what shocked me, was because I never had expected that. I didn't know that William Bickerton, first of all, was persecuted by his own church. Second of all, I never realized that on his deathbed, he would have this read at his funeral as a message from the grave. I mean, that to me blew me away. And when I read that part where he says, oh, that my words were now written, that they are printed in a book, I really related to Mike Quinn, because as I'm going through this, some people might, you know, look at it, but it's an emotional and a spiritual journey when you're doing this. I mean, and it's an intellectual journey, number one, but you just can't help but immersing yourself, especially when you're writing biography. And I'm like, when I read that, you know, on his deathbed, he had asked for his story to be told, that jolted me. because here I am trying to write it. And I wasn't alone, as Joe will see. You see a lot of these stories. You as a Mormon historian and as a historian in general, if you know that you're going to have a good story is if you find those things and if you're like feeling and being a part of their life. That's the only way you're going to do it. Greg Prince talks a lot about that too. I mean, that's the way, if you're going to be a good historian, you have to be completely dedicated and sacrificed to do it. And it just becomes a labor of love. And you don't even care if anybody reads the book. You just want to get the story out. So it was a lot of fun.
There's so much to touch on in all of that. So, but I'm going to keep mine brief because we were actually getting quite a few great questions coming through here. I mean, one of the big themes I saw in the book as well, and you both kind of touched on it, was access. And, you know, not just with church archives, but where do you find the information and who has, you know, the record of what? You got to go to New Mexico to get something here or there. You know, and also with the church themselves, with access to their archives, we've gone through phases where that was difficult for several historians for their own respective projects. But I'm going to actually, I mean, we could touch on all of that stuff for hours, I'm sure, because it's fascinating. But I do want to throw in, Tom Kimball did ask, how many historians wish they could go back and significantly redo their work? So who wants to take that one?
I don't think any of them really did. I think I picked a really good group, Tom. See, if you had done the book, you would have picked people who would never have wanted their books ever to be published. I pick people that actually do good work and publish their book. So that is what you would do, Tom, but I do it a little different.
You're going to let that stand? Josh already's throwing down at Tom Kimball.
That's right. I'm just the moderator here. So it's, you know, it's up to Tom now if he wants to reply to that. But yeah, we've got some interesting, we've got, you know, tighter shots fired here than we had it since we've had it at Carthage. So rolling into the next one here, Andrew Hamilton really wants to get Mike Quinn to publish his journals. What do you think the odds are of that ever happening?
They'll be accessible after his passing at Beinecke Library. I think he wants to do the memoir. I think he wrote the memoir and thought and is considering publishing that. Now, I know not, Mike is working every time he and I have any contact, which we try about every month. And Mike has made it really clear to me he's focused on these two volumes of New Plural Marriage. So right now, that's all that Mike's thinking about. He's got amazing laser vision. He blocks out everybody and everything when he works on stuff.
Josh, can I answer one of my insights from the book to Tom's question?
Please do.
So talking about rewriting or working on their work, something that I've learned from this book and talking to these authors, like Linda Newell, it's not that they regret the work or that they would do it different necessarily, but they also acknowledge the imperfections in the work. So like Linda talks about, when she was writing the biography, that's when Mark Hoffman had some documents that hadn't yet been, you know, proved, disproved, I guess, as forgeries. And so historians were working with what they could at the time. And what I've really learned about from Linda is she's one of the best at doing this. She talks about her work and she talks about the imperfections in the work because everybody has imperfections. It shows up everywhere. But she talks about it very matter-of-factly and honestly. And I just think that that's the best way to do it. She says, you know, in our first version of the book, we used a document that was later proved to be a forgery. And I can't even remember, Joe, you probably know which document she's talking about.
I keep thinking it's the Dunham letter, but I know Mike used that in something. And I'm trying to think if she used this. Oh, the Joseph Smith III blessing document that was what she used. She and Val used.
Yeah, and that's history itself, right? To the fact that Mark Hoffman and the and these documents become its own type of history. And so I don't know if that answers Tom's question, but I definitely think that just as a researcher myself and as someone who puts a lot of work out there, which means I'm doing things very quickly and making mistakes, it's nice to see people model how you sort of keep integrity in the work as you're doing that. So
that's really good, Lindsay. I think thank you for that. You redeemed Tom a little bit on that. But yeah, Linda and Val, if there was a book that you would say, yeah, this is really amazing work, it probably is their work. Everybody I've ever given that book to have them read has come back to me and said how much they loved it. I've given other people, a good example would be Jim Allen. And Jim Allen is a great historian, one of the great Mormon historians. But his biography of William Clayton is really boring to the average person. And so I thought, I got these people hooked on Mormon history, you know, after having them read Linda's. And then I gave them Jim's book, and they gave it back to me after a couple of days and said, I can't read this. You know, so Linda and Val did an amazing job. And Will Bagley, the editor he is, has already sent me a list of typos and errors in the book. So I don't think any of them were his. They may, some of them could have been yours, Daniel. I don't know. But but you know, I mean, that's the editor in Will. He's already done that.
What do you think, real quick, Daniel? Do you have anything now as new information comes in or out that you would like to go back and do differently?
Yeah, I wonder how many people and historians actually do this. See, I'm one of these weird people. I can never turn my brain off. My poor wife will tell you that. It's really a terrible curse that I have. And I'm always constantly thinking about, every once in a while, like just thought will pop in my head of like, oh, I could have did this differently. I could have added this footnote. Oh, these sources I could have used, because you can never include everything in the book. And as you get older, and or at least I'll speak for myself. I mean, I'm only in my early 30s. So it's like, as I get older, I start thinking about things and I go, oh, your interpretation changes a little bit and you start thinking about things a little bit. But for the most part, no, I'm very happy with the book. But over time, yeah, I mean, you look at it, I find mistakes here and there and things like that. I am thankful that the vast majority, you know, I've been able to have that. I feel confident, and it really wasn't my fault, because thankfully I was able to use the book as part of my dissertation to get my PhD. So I had to, not only did it get peer reviewed by signature, I had to get hounded by the people that were on my defense and my advisors. So unfortunately I had to think about the book way more than I ever wanted to. So I was thankful. But because of all that experience, it does make you think a lot about like, this could have been done differently. But that's history. I mean, history is not perfect. And I think that's one of the great things about Joe's book, is that, you know, Richard Bushman, in a really beautiful excerpt on the back, basically sums it up beautifully and says, it's a human enterprise. I think that's how he describes it. It's you know, it's humans writing about humans, and you're trying to get into the motive behind these humans and why they're doing things. I mean, it almost sounds silly when you say that, right? Like, we're trying to figure out why dead people did what they did and put motive behind it. I mean, it's magic, and sometimes it's illusion. You have to kind of put yourself into it. So long story short, yeah, you're always kind of second guessing at some points, but at some point you just have to look at the sources and add a little bit of magic, and hopefully you're hitting the nail pretty close to the head.
It's a really good point, because one of the factors that I think some people kind of get lost in, you know, from the outskirts, is historians aren't just writing for their, you know, people interested in their work. They're also writing. They have to know that other historians are going to be writing and critiquing their work as well. And so, you know, I'm sure that that's in the back of your mind all the time as well. But so I'm sure, sure that at some points you go through and think, oh, I wonder if Mike Quinn's going to ever read this, or I wonder if, you know, Joe Geisinger's ever going to read this, and just what are they going to think if they actually read what you just wrote? So those are really good points that I think this book kind of gives you a little bit of that perspective of what the historians kind of have to go through in putting the work out, and how the interpretation can change, it can evolve, it can grow. As you, like you said, we're just putting together the stories of people from the past, you know, and what actually happened. And some of that, you know, is based on the work of other historians, and then you just piece it together the best you can and hope that you don't get wrecked from it. So real quick, you touched on it. I've got it right here. So Richard Bushman on the back wrote, the last sentence says, "These essays help us understand that writing human history is a deeply human enterprise." And I think that's perfect. I really like that as well. So we're actually flying through this. We're getting really close to 8 o'clock, but we've got a couple more comments that have come through here that maybe we can kind of touch on if you guys are okay to go over for a few minutes. And so also we were, you know, kind of throwing a shout out to Susan Staker. She jumped into the conversation. We got the great honor of having her with us tonight. She mentioned that Jill Mulvey and Maura Beecher were my mentors in learning about the Relief Society. So she wanted to throw that little note in there. John Dinger has thrown in some really good questions. He's got three here. I don't know if we can hit all three if you guys want to touch on it, but I'm going to read them all. Let's just go crazy. Have some fun with it. So for Joe, did anyone turn you down? Who do you want for volume two besides Lindsay Hampson Park? I threw that last part in there. And what deceased author do you wish would write a chapter for you?
Are all the questions from John for me then, it sounds like? Is that right?
Yeah, he said three questions for Joe.
Okay.
So anybody else can jump in if they'd like, but he specifically called.
Yeah, turned me down, yes. And I'm not so sure I really want to say who they were because, volume two is something that we really would like to do. And I'm hoping that some of those people that turned me down for volume one will be interested in doing volume two, since it was not an easy thing for people to say yes to me. First of all, I had never published a book before, or I had a book before. So I'm brand new to that part. Signature's got a great history and a great track record. But even with that, there are some folks that find that Signature may be too cutting edge for them. And so they're afraid to go there. The other thing that I ended up with was for a few people, quite a few people actually, turned me down just because of their age. I talked about Val Avery and not having her be able to write that chapter and be a complimentary chapter with Linda's. So there were people that I went to that I knew that just weren't. A good example would be, two people. One is Becky Bartholomew, and the other is, Susan maybe can remind me of the other. It's Becky Cornwall. Both of those have written books, and both of them have not been acknowledged in some things either that they've written. And so I was hoping to get that. But because of age, I think Becky Cornwall actually has cancer right now. I believe she's going through cancer. So, you know, so there were those people that just, it wasn't something even possible for them. So, yeah, I was turned down. And like I say, some of those people had real real good reasons. Others, I think, just were skeptical. And I mean, you know, Linda Newell to do it, you know, this is, you know, she's got grandkids, she's got all this other stuff going on. And she's like, why would I want to do that? You know? So I'm actually very grateful that those people trusted me enough to do that. You know, and getting John Turner, I think about how lucky I am that John Turner was willing to do it. And he kept asking me, he said, you really want me to do that? He goes, this sort of sounds peculiar. You want me to talk about myself and what I did, you know? I like talking about other people and what they did. So, yeah, that was something. And then the kinds of, or who we want to get on. Well, I'm really wanting to get new people like with Daniel, how Daniel, you know, a new person on the scene, a new author writing a book, and a book that actually ended up winning Best Biography at both MHA and John Whitmer. And so, you know, that's the kind of people I'm looking at as well as others. So, okay.
Yeah, I think you covered it really well. I think everybody, the second they hit the last page of this one, is going to already be immediately looking forward to volume two. So hopefully you got some great gets here. And so hopefully we'll continue that work, because I think a couple people in the comments have mentioned just how important it is to know the history behind the history. So Tom Kimball was one of them. He also threw in a comment here. A good historian is writing for themselves and look forward to the criticism as they retool their understanding of the event. So I thought that was a great comment.
That is, Tom, you redeemed yourself.
Good job, Tom. Thank you for joining us tonight. So we are to 8:03 here, and I think one more comment, if I can find it. That I wanted to throw in. So Susan Staker just threw in a great Turner quote. Historians are always on some level talking about themselves. So I really liked that too.
That's great.
Can I say something towards that, since I love to talk about myself? I don't have anything published. I'm working on it. I find it very intimidating. It's not the format or medium that I'm used to using. I use a podcast, but that was my realization that whole podcast really helped me in relationship to polygamy and Mormon marriage and things like that. And like Daniel, what he was talking about, you develop through the going through it. It is a spiritual process. It is a And I don't even care if you're from the tradition you're writing about. I know non-Mormon historians that have a similar process, because as you're going through the history, you're learning things and you're gathering information and standing out to hear the things that really resonate with you. And so, anyway, I'm just backing up that quote. I think it's lovely.
Great input there, Lindsay. Appreciate it, because it really is important that, you know, we all consider, you know, everybody is doing their work from their own perspective, and it all just kind of comes together to put together the story as we go. So let's see, I don't have any other, there's lots of great comments in here, and hopefully everybody continues to keep commenting and throwing in their input as we go. Let's take one last question here. And it's from, G. Christie. Are you surprised, and are the contributors surprised at how thirsty readers have been for this book and for their insights on their works?
Being a book nerd, I do have to admit, I wondered if people would find the interest I had, like I said, about reading Leonard talking about Great Basin Kingdom or Harmon Hardy, Carmen Hardy writing about Solemn Covenant, and actually Juanita Brooks, Lindsay and my favorite lady. She also wrote an article about her writing. And so, yeah, I wondered if people would. What helped me was the number of people. A good example would be Jason at Signature Books. Now, Jason does the layout and stuff. And he actually, as he was doing the layout, he actually had to read the chapter. He couldn't stop because he's supposed to just be looking at it, doing the layout, and then going to the next. He couldn't do that. He had to actually read the entire chapter. He found them so good. So that was one thing. Ron Prittis read a couple of chapters early on and said the same thing, that he couldn't stop reading. He could not stop doing that. So I thought we may be onto something here. I think the authors are enjoying it. If you see Todd Compton posting on Facebook at times, it's so fun to watch him because he says, you know, people will be started asking him about In Sacred Loneliness. And he goes, well, just go to Joe's book and you can read about it. He goes, I don't have to write the whole big thing out anymore. I just have people go to that. So I think there's some of that going on there.
That's a great input on that. So Susan Staker at the very end, we'll kind of close with this. She threw in, one of the things I most like about this book's that folks come to see Joe Geisner as a hero of Mormon studies. So just wanted to make sure that got thrown into the conversation here.
Susan's too kind.
You are kind of like the keeper of the realm, though. Like, you're the guy in the Indiana Jones, we have to go through the gate to pass.
Well, Lindsay did mention the 20 minutes to the email. You know, you ask for something from Joe and you get an email 20 minutes later. And she's even like, you've even proven that on this call where she said, wasn't it such and such? And like within probably 45 seconds, you had looked up and found the answer to that. So, yeah, I think that's well deserved to say that. So the gatekeeper, I think, is pretty solid. So we'll go ahead and close it up. Everybody here, Writing Mormon History, edited by Joe Geisner. Daniel Stone is in here. He may be closer to the bottom, but I think that's alphabetical, so don't even think about that. This is not done by hierarchy whatsoever. So Daniel's chapter is pretty incredible as well. You can pick it up from Signature Books, so make sure you do that if you haven't already. Buy five, just buy several copies, you know, just keep them around, you know, put them different places throughout the house so that you know, just wherever you are, that you have access to it at all times. We want to really, really thank Joe Geisner for coming on and talking about his book here.
Thanks, Josh. Can I add one thing about your little thing about the book? Benchmark Books is a great place for people to get a copy. I know they've got it. They've actually got it. And I ordered 30 copies. I had the two copies that I got as editor. And I'm now without, I had to give my own hard copy that I had for myself. I had to end up giving that away. So it has been something that people like for presents.
Here's what I think you should do. If you go and you buy it from Benchmark Books, if you call on the phone, because you have to call Benchmark on the phone, call and prank call them first. First call's a prank call, hang up, call again, order the book. Tell Brian Buchanan I sent you.
Pretty much everybody, I think, knew that already, but it's good to reiterate that, you know, you always make sure that you can throw in any prank call to Brian Buchanan possible. We want to thank Daniel Stone for joining us this evening. So thank you, Daniel. Any closing remarks you want to grace us with?
Oh, thanks for having me. And thank you, Joe, for this wonderful book. And everything you guys do at Sunstone is wonderful. So I really appreciate it. And I do want to give a shout out to Sunstone. You guys were the first Mormon history conference I've ever went to. And I was hooked. It was awesome. And I met so many wonderful people. Joe was one of them. John Hatch, Mike Marquardt. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. And every time I come back, and I was a Bickertonite from Michigan, and you guys just welcomed me with open arms, and I just really appreciate it. So thank you.
Yeah, Sunstone's great.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Daniel. Don't forget too, Joe and Daniel, that people look forward to meeting you at Sunstone as well. It's, you know, not just about you, Daniel, and everybody you get to meet. People are excited to meet you too. So really appreciate when you can come out and join us, and it's always a pleasure. So I've had a fantastic time. Make sure that you pick up the book, Signature, Benchmark. Lindsay, anything, closing remarks you want to grace us with here?
Just that I absolutely think it's important history to read about the history of how we got this, because that will help you understand and contextualize it as you develop your own history of Mormon history. So I think that that's important. And Daniel, I just think it's great that you came to Sunstone. I remember that, because I remember looking at your title going like, oh, that's a name, Bickertonite. We don't hear that very often. So I think you're doing really important work within the Mormon diaspora. And I think that's really great. And Joe, you know, I think you're great. So Josh, you're all right.
I do. I appreciate just being in the same presence with you three. So, you know, I'll call that a win. I'm playing with house money at this point. So I'll just leave you guys to discuss your great work and try to keep my mouth shut as much as possible. So Writing Mormon History, thank you guys for coming. Everybody, please support, pick up the book anywhere you can. Thank you for supporting Sunstone. Consider donating. Follow us on our podcast, subscribe. Also, you know, Lindsay posted a comment to Moroni Benali's project right there. Make sure you support that. It's been a pleasure, everybody. Hope everybody stays safe. And I mean, things are crazy right now, but I'm glad that we can carve out some time for, you know, a conversation like this. So thank you again, and hope you guys enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you, Josh.
Thanks. Thank you, everybody, for watching, and stay safe.